Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks very much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. All the movie talk among conservatives these days is understandably revolving around the recent release of the film from the Daily Wire's Matt Walsh called Am I Racist?, which I reviewed recently for Front Page Mag, actually. So it has kind of eclipsed much of the talk among conservative audiences about another recent film that was aimed squarely at conservative audiences called simply Reagan, a biopic, as they're called, about the life and major achievements of course, former President Ronald Reagan. I reviewed that one for Front Page Mag, too, about a month ago. It's based on Paul Kengor's outstanding 2006 biography, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism. And the movie stars Dennis Quaid in what I think will probably be the role of a lifetime for him as, of course, Ronald Reagan. He really embodies Reagan's rugged physicality and captures his sense of humor, the cadence of his voice, even the mischievous twinkle in his eye. And the film hits many of the most notable highlights of Reagan's life and political achievements, saving lives as a teenage lifeguard, becoming a Hollywood leading man, combating communist thugs in Hollywood unions, running for president, the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet evil empire, and more. The climactic sequence of the film, and I don't think I'm giving much away here, is Reagan's epic showdown with the Soviet Union and his delivery of the Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall speech. The movie also presents some notable setbacks, such as his failed marriage to actress Jane Wyman, the Iran-Contra scandal, and of course the assassination attempt which very nearly killed him, including the moment that Reagan, with typical good humor, told his doctors, "Please tell me you're Republicans." But primarily, the through line of the story is Ronnie's unshakable self-confidence, which led him to trust in what he believed to be his God-given mission to end communism, for which the Russians referred to him as the Crusader. I gave the film a thumbs up in my review, but of course, left-leaning movie critics did not want a film about a conservative icon to do well, so they ignored it or panned it. But so what? On the Rotten Tomatoes review site, Reagan earned an audience favorability score of a whopping 98%. Now, whose opinion matters more, the critics or the audience? Well, as it happens, I am joined today by the screenwriter of that film, and we're going to talk about his experience writing it, the making of the film, and how the entertainment landscape is changing. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations that we are having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a writer, screenwriter, producer, director, and the founder and president of I-40 Studios. He's the author of 3 books and 60 screenplays, among them the Clint Eastwood blockbuster Space Cowboys, Soul Surfer starring Dennis Quaid, and most recently Reagan, also starring Dennis Quaid. Howie Klausner, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Mark, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I love having filmmakers and novelists on the show because I believe the stories that we tell ourselves really shape and define who we are as individuals and as a culture and even as a civilization. Do you think that's fair to say, or am I being kind of pretentious about it?
No, not at all. 100%. I mean, we are the consciousness of our lives, of our societies is the stories that we tell each other. I mean, my heavens, a commercial on TV is telling you a story, what we pass down to our kids, whether it's the Bible or, hey, this is what happened to me in high school. It becomes the fabric of who you are. And that's been the case, I think, since human beings have been walking around.
Yeah, and these days I think it's an especially vital endeavor because there's just so much at stake in the culture wars that we're engaged in. Again, would you think that's fair to say, or am I making too big a deal out of it?
Not at all. Not at all. And I think what we're going to talk about today has kind of demonstrated that a little bit.
Very glad to have you on to talk about storytelling and movies in Hollywood. First, give us a little background about yourself, how you got into screenwriting and all that.
Well, I grew up in Nashville. I grew up in music, actually. And I actually traveled the country in a children's choir with the famous Bill Gaither Trio, and this was gospel music, and it was the stories that they would tell to these audiences. That the music was wonderful, but it would just enthrall them. And I fell in love with storytelling at that point. I was that kid in high school that wrote the sketches for the football team's pep rally because nobody else would do it. So I'm really just a project for you. Okay, so process of elimination. I moved out to Hollywood to be an actor. That didn't work out so great. But I really tried lots and lots of things. But the one thing I kept falling back on was writing. And so I got really serious about it after teaching school for several years. And just put the nose to the grindstone. And 7 years later, I sold my first screenplay with my partner at the time, Ken Kaufman. And it was Space Cowboys. And I've been doing it ever since.
Wow. Space Cowboys was your first then, huh? Or first sale?
It was my breakthrough. It wasn't the first script I ever wrote, for heaven's sakes. No, it was actually lucky number 13 for me. But I joined up with Ken Kaufman, who was my partner at the time. And we wrote together for several years and very amicably parted ways. But it was wonderful. He and I were partners at the beginning of my writing career.
Well, you've had a long, successful career in Hollywood. How would you describe yourself politically?
It's such a danger. I'm way past caring what anybody thinks about my politics any longer. I never even made a ruse about being anything but a conservative. But when I say conservative, I'm a constitutionalist. I just think they got it right in 1776. And that's where I've always stood. I'm a lot like Reagan. I grew up the son of Kennedy Democrats. Reagan was a Democrat before he became a Republican. Reagan is the guy that flipped me just on his confidence and his love of people, even people who disagreed with him. And so really, if I was to describe my politics, it's like, yeah, man, I'm a Reagan Republican. But it's really funny you ask that, Mark, because I think sort of in the consciousness, when people think of Reagan, they think of just this hard right conservative. This guy was one of the great conciliators and compromisers in all of American history. And that's how he got things done. I mean, sure, he never let go of his principles. He wouldn't sign those away, but he was a smart enough guy to know, if I don't work with other people, I'm not going to get anything done. And so I think that, to me, that he is, it's funny that, you know, that I would be led to write the screenplay of his life, because his whole attitude about life has just basically been mine professionally. Same thing.
How did you get, well, let me back up first before I get to the Reagan gig itself. What, as a conservative Christian in Hollywood, has that been problematic for you working there in the belly of the beast, so to speak? Has that been an issue for you in terms of your gigs?
Well, let me see if I can really just short circuit that answer. There's a reason I'm talking to you from Franklin, Tennessee. So after years and years in Hollywood, I can say this. I say it with nothing but love. But I was kind of I like telling. I've told writers groups this. I was canceled before getting canceled was cool. And so this was way back in the day. And over the years, some executives who I still cherish, you know, it's just what it is, you know, came to me and said, listen, I really wanted to hire you for this one thing. And there are movies you would recognize. I'm not going to tell you what they were. It just, I couldn't, because, you're kind of that conservative kind of guy. And, you know, you're probably a Christian. And, you know, it's like, it was sort of like, if anything, I was almost happy to hear it, because I thought, man, I'm just failing on my own, which of course everybody does at some point. But I mean, so I sort of woke up and went, you know what, I'm not really going to make it as a viable on the market screenwriter just simply because of who I am. I mean, I can't say it enough times. I have nothing but love and respect for those people. And I understand the system they're in. You know, sometimes you gotta hire the other person because of their identity. I get it. So I moved to Tennessee and was able to reinvent myself actually pretty quickly. I fell into writing and producing a movie in Memphis right away in 2010. Called The Grace Card. And there you go. I was an independent filmmaker just overnight. that's kind of where I am. I still work, you know, like a producers will call me to do a production rewrite or something like that. But my last several films, including Reagan, have been independently born.
Okay. Well, how did you end up getting the Reagan gig?
Well, it's funny. I was approached by the producers to come pitch for it. Oh, I want to say 2009. And it was down between me and a couple of other writers, and they didn't choose me. And I, of course, was devastated, brokenhearted. Actually, when you do what I do for a living, you do that all the time. It, you know, you don't get the gig, you don't get the gig. You just move on, and that's fine. But it was like, I was like, doggone it. I really liked what I pitched and proposed to them. Well, it didn't work out, and they had to throw the script in the trash and start all over again. And so they came back to me and said, "Would you be interested in?" And they liked my take, which was essentially the thing with the Russian spy telling you the story. And I said, "Absolutely." So that was in 2010, and we've been a band of brothers for 14 years now. So it was a long, long road.
I don't think a lot of people realize just how long it takes some movies to get from script to screen. And this is one of those instances. I guess this movie, I understand, had to jump through so many hoops over the course of years to get into theaters. Were you beginning to wonder if it would ever actually make it to the big screen?
Oh, of course. Of course. I mean, everything from just, you know, the first model, of course, because the studios were actually interested in the beginning, and thought, well, okay, we're just going to, you know, make it in the traditional manner, you know, probably, you know, I won't say the names of the studios, but they were very interested, you know, but really what the thinking was okay, but we will have ultimate creative control. Hollywood being Hollywood, you can't really blame the executive producers going, no, that's a, you know, that's the deal breaker. It's like, you know, here's our script. We will make it according to that. And of course, I can't tell you how many drafts I went through the script. But I mean, we went through so of course we couldn't get our financing out of there. We had to go private, which is its own journey. If anybody's ever raised, you know, it's one thing to raise, you know, a couple million dollars. It's like, you know, we're north of 25 million bucks. I mean, that's a real movie right there. So in the independent space, that's tough. We had our first director die. We had COVID. We had three different lead actors who were going to play Reagan for all kinds of reasons. Yeah, it's just not going to work out. Then we had a writer's strike and an actor's strike. It was just like, I think somebody is trying to not let this movie. And it's interesting that and the funny thing is, Dennis Quaid said, really, when he signed on to the project, is whatever we do, we are not releasing this movie in an election year. And here we are. So, you know, but, you know, that whole for such a time as this, that, you know, I'll segue into a point that if you'd like to explore, you know, this movie was never intended to sway any elections or anything like that. As I've said, you know, as I've introduced the movie in some of the premiere screenings, you know, I did not write a Republican movie. I wrote an American movie. This is an American movie. But it's just funny, you know, sometimes divine hands are moving and you just roll with it. So here we are in 2024, releasing Reagan.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about Dennis Quaid in just a moment, but let me get back to the story that you wanted to tell and the structure of it. Because one criticism that's been aimed at the movie is that it takes this what's called a cradle-to-grave approach as a biopic. And the criticism is that it might have worked better to focus on just a slice of Reagan's life that was representative of him as a man and as a president. And as I reviewed the movie for frontpagemag.com, and in my review, I wrote that I don't think that's a problem in this instance, because I think you wove all of those high and low lights together very successfully. But was that ever part of the discussion in terms of making the film? You know, how, in what way, what to focus on and how to structure it? Or was it always the intent to kind of cover the broader sweep of Reagan's life and career?
I think it was really it always was. And I'll tell you why, because the spine of the movie was basically one guy, the president of the United States, standing, representing the United States and all its values in, I'm going to bring that wall down. Not me personally, but freedom is going to win here. And it became the focus of his presidency. If you don't see the road that got, this was not a political expedient for Reagan. He knew as he was going through this is probably going to be political suicide for me if it doesn't work, and even my party. But he so believed in it. Well, you have to go all the way back to the beginning of his life to see where that comes from. And it came as much from, you know, his own consciousness in hearing about the evils of the first generation of Soviet communism, but from his mother and from his pastor. And so, you know, if you don't see and then see the journey of his life, it was like it was all leading to this, you know, everything from being, you know, he was a college athlete. He was a lifeguard, by the way. He was, you know, he was an actor. He was a union president. He was a corporate spokesman. He was a governor. And it was only really when he reached this point of his life that it was time to face the Soviet Union down. He realized, and that's the story that we're telling here, it's like that was all a preparatory step-by-step process for this character. And it really was. And so, you know, to just say I got it, you know, yeah, you can really, really unpack the whole Gorbachev versus Reagan thing, you know, scene by scene in a 2-hour. Yeah, I mean, and I'd like to see somebody make that. I would love that. But I think to really understand Reagan, you got, I mean, here's a funny thing for you. The first draft of the script, they almost fired me, was 208 pages, and they just flipped. I was like, what? You know, it's like, we're trying to make a 2-hour movie. And I actually fought them. I just said, guys, I don't think this is a 2-hour movie. I think this is a limited series. I think this is probably a 12-hour story, journey. And they were very correct in saying that's not what we're doing. it's hard, and I understand the criticism because, man, it is hard to cram that much life into 2 hours.
Yeah, and just to clue listeners in to what you were talking about a moment ago, 208 pages, that's just enormous for a screenplay. One page of a screenplay is generally considered approximating 1 minute of screen time. So they're usually, you know, a 2-hour movie would be a 120 page screenplay. So a 208 page screenplay, you're talking a miniseries there.
And there's another thing. Every page basically has a price tag on it. so, you start averaging that, a 208 page movie is going to cost a lot more than a 120 page movie any way you slice it.
Exactly. Another thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that when you adapt a book to a screenplay, and you adapted your screenplay from Paul Kengor's book, The Crusader, by a great biography of Reagan, when you adapt a book to a screenplay, you have to ruthlessly leave out an enormous amount and then make all the parts that you kept flow together seamlessly. And I think you did that really well in Reagan. Was there any aspect of his life or achievements that you wanted to include but couldn't make it work?
Oh, I mean, I wouldn't say that I couldn't include, but I couldn't really expand on them. One of the things that we were always so interested in was his first relationship with his first girlfriend who he thought he was going to marry, and she broke his heart and said, no, I'm not going to marry you. So we had to kind of gloss over that. As a matter of fact, I think it ended up on the cutting room floor at the end. I wanted to make that all the producers went, because it was such a tender and endearing and just heart-rending story part of it. So things like that, more of the personal stuff, you know, the dissolution of his marriage to Jane Wyman, because I'm a character guy. That's what I'm interested in, character and all these things but they formed him for this. So we, you know, it's in there. You can see his marriage does end, his first marriage before he meets Nancy, but just the emotional journeys that run through these things. The 1976 election, where he loses at the convention to Gerald Ford, he was absolutely certain that God, for lots of reasons, if you watch the movie, you'll know that God had tapped him, you're going to be the president of the United States. So when he loses there, he's just devastated. And not only he's not because I lost, but it's like, you know, am I crazy here? Am I thinking God's telling me something and he's really not, you know, which caused him for, you know, 3 or 4 years to just, he didn't go into a tailspin because he wasn't that kind of a guy, but he was deeply meditative about what, you know, why was I wrong? And sure enough, it was for such a time as this, you were meant to be elected in 1980. And he was.
Yeah. Another criticism of, and I don't mean to focus on the criticisms, but they raise interesting points. Yeah,
it's part of it.
Was that Reagan himself in the movie is painted as a little bit too much of a saint. Now, again, I don't think that's true. For one thing, I don't think Reagan himself had any dramatically dark sides to his personality. But I think that criticism stems mostly from the fact that nothing short of depicting him as Dr. Evil would have satisfied the mainstream critics. And I'm glad that you painted him the way that you did, because I and tens of millions of fellow Americans have no interest in watching a 2-hour trashing of an American hero where he's depicted as kind of an anti-hero struggling with dark aspects of his character. But anyway, was that something that you wrestled with as the screenwriter, trying to fully humanize him without making him too much of a saint?
Well, here's what I think, and by the way, I'm finishing up a blog right now that I'm writing about that. An artist should never defend his work or explain his work. It should speak for itself. But when it's wrong, when a point is brought up that's wrong, and wrong for the right, for all the wrong reasons, then yeah, without anger, I'm going to respond to that. That, yeah, because I've seen the term hagiography, which, as you know, is the definition of a biography of a saint. So I have a really funny story to tell you. I'll just say the name because it doesn't matter now. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man. Richard Dreyfuss was considering being part of the movie. And I had about a 1-hour conversation with him about the script. It was a pretty much a dressing down by, you know, one of the great actors of all time. So it was kind of a thank you, sir. May I have another? As he's really just hammering me on the script. But he used the term hagiography several times. I didn't respond at the time, and I should also say something else. I don't write movies for critics, but I do learn from them. So I do. I glance at what they say. It's like, yeah, they're smart people. I get it. I'm not mad at them. That's their job. But the funny thing is, but the more I thought about it, and then I saw it again. You, of course, are aware that, you know, we have a disparity between the Rotten Tomatoes critics liking the movie at 18% and the audience that have written reviews and responded to it at 98%. So it's like, okay, that's what is that telling you? And here's what it's telling. Here's what it tells me. And I'm sorry for this long introduction to the answer to your question. The thing about it is this: the heroic journey is not a hagiography. And I believe the movie we wrote showed not only plenty of his flaws and his outright failures, but even there's a section in the movie where it will seem like a little bit like right now, a little montage of how much he was actually hated. So, you didn't see that in hagiographies. You didn't see that. So he was a flesh and blood human being. However, exactly like you said, we have reached this anti-hero sort of postmodern world in our literature and our movies, and we deliberately just said, no, we're going back to the heroic journey. He rose to something bigger than himself with all his flaws and failures intact, and he won the game. And that to me is the architecture of the greatest storytelling of all time, and it just so happens to be true. It's like, this is a true story, people. We didn't make something up for the mythology. This really happened, and this was that guy. So I don't get all bent out of shape about it, but I'm just like, as you just said, I have to question the motivations behind someone. Seriously, some of them are the worst reviews I've ever gotten. I've gotten bad reviews. I know what that, but you can read it and go, man, this is personal and this is political. You're not judging the movie, especially with, I mean, and then I'll stop this long diatribe of mine. But in all honesty, I've written a lot of movies. I've been a part of a lot of movies. I've never had as many times audiences literally on their feet and crying at the end of the film. And so really, that's not my brilliance. It's not even Dennis Quaid's brilliance. You know what it is? It has struck a nerve. Whatever it is, and it just, as an artist, sometimes you just let go and just let it happen, and that's kind of where we are.
Well, that's a point that I brought up in my review, was that the Rotten Tomatoes disparity between what the critics rated it as you said, 18 or 19%. I mean, you'd think it was the worst movie ever made.
Some guy said that. One of the reviews said, this is the worst movie ever. And I was like, oh, come on, man. They haven't seen some of my earlier movies, which were way worse.
Well, that would be an achievement of its own, I suppose.
I guess so.
A memorable one. But no, it's obviously politically motivated. And the disparity between that and the audience rating of 98%, I mean, you almost cannot get any better than 98%.
No. So that I didn't tells even think you that everything. Existed. I didn't even think that existed, Mark. And I questioned it at first. And sure enough, man, they just keep coming in. It's just connecting with the audiences. everybody? Of course not. But the people that are interested enough to go to the movies, including many people with D beside their name, it's like it's a character story. That's what it is, story of a man.
And I love that you said earlier in our conversation that you didn't write a Republican movie. You wrote a movie for Americans, because I think that really nails it.
I did. I mean, that was the intention all along. As a matter of fact, when they hired me, I said, because these are pretty conservative guys with no apology. But I said, let's please understand each other. I'm pretty conservative, at least as far as my love of America and Constitution and things like that. But I said, I'm not going to write a Republican movie. And they said, we don't want that. So I'm not going to make a commercial for a political party. The agenda, I mean, of course there's some politics in there. For heaven's sakes, he was the president of the United States. How do you avoid politics? But, you know, there's other than a one or two points that he really cared about, like taxes and things like that. We really don't get, this doesn't become a platform for the Republican Party.
What about Dennis Quaid? Let's talk about Dennis Quaid for a moment. What about him as Reagan? In my review, I wrote that he so inhabited the character so well, so authentically and sincerely and unironically, that he really brings Reagan to life without just doing an imitation of him. How did you feel about Quaid's performance? And did you get to interact with him or work with him much on this?
I did. I was on set. I was, you know, as I said, we were a band of brothers. There was no way any one of us was going to just thank you for your script. You know, goodbye. We have it now. It's like we had to hang together like a team. So I was there the whole way and through post-production and everything. I agree 100% with what you just said about Dennis. Dennis told me, he said, my challenge is to not do a Ronald Reagan imitation for 2 hours. And that statement, of course, says a lot about his performance, but also on a personal level. Dennis is a born impressionist. When he was a kid, he wanted to be Rich Little. You remember Rich Little?
Oh, sure.
He wanted to be that guy. So he can imitate anybody. One of the funny things he did just one day, something was going wrong. There was a big delay on set and we're waiting. And he begins this little dialogue between Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, you know, in his imitation. It was the funniest thing I've ever heard in all my life, because it sounded like these two guys are sitting here next to each other talking. It was so funny. So, well, to finally answer your question, he did inhabit the character. He did, and he cared, and he had the right attitude going in, as he said in his interviews. He goes, I was scared to death. I said no at first because he said, this role's too big, and all I can do is screw it up. And finally, as he also said as an actor, that usually tells me I'm supposed to do it. You know, so he came into it with a lot of humility, a lot of, I don't want to say timidity, but just, you know, you could just see he was like, man, I'm not going to screw this up because I love this man. And then once he started working, it was amazing to watch him on set. It's like this. I mean, he's all that in a more balanced world. Let's say a world of say 10, 12 years ago, there is no doubt he would be nominated for Best Picture Academy Award and most probably win. We're not expecting that, you know, obviously with the climate we're living in Hollywood, but I think he gave a masterful performance.
Yeah. I think I said in my review that I think this Reagan role will probably be the one that Quaid is ultimately remembered for, and in a good way. So it sounds like he felt some pressure knowing how important this film would be to millions of Reagan admirers. Did you feel that pressure too writing the movie? Did you feel, were you able to put that out of your mind, or did you feel the weight of the expectation?
Yes, I did. I truly, truly did. You know, I'd like to say, no, I'm not going to think about that. I'm just going to. But, you know, he was my president, too. I was in college when I, quote, flipped, as I like to tell everybody. He had me at the night after his when he returned to the joint session of Congress after his assassination. And to watch that moment in American history, to see both sides of the aisle, truly both sides, standing, clapping, both of them crying and everything, and him just standing there. So like it was like our dad's back. That's kind of what it felt like. And so to go back to that and to come across that and know that millions and millions and millions of people feel that way, it's like, yeah, you can't escape that. You can't, it's like, man. Whatever. I mean, I was respectful of it. That said, I didn't fall into, as we talked about earlier, well, he was just different than all of us. He was a saint. It was like, no, he wasn't. He was a man. And that's what I love the most about him.
Well, there's a lot to talk about with that film, but let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Hollywood. Hollywood is not the gatekeeper for entertainment anymore, is it? It just seems like year after year, the disconnect is growing between Hollywood's content and values on the one hand, and what American audiences want to see on the other hand. And are we seeing the rise of a sort of parallel culture with these independent production companies that are creating content for the underserved audiences in what the elites call flyover country? And do you think that's the future of movies?
I do. And I think that the future is here. It is happening. I have my own company here, developing a lot of material, working with private equity. The distribution, it's always been about distribution, Mark. You see, the iron hold that Hollywood always had, that it will always be our product, this is our town, we do it our way, we put it out, is they always had the hold on distribution. Well, the internet and streaming have blown all that apart. And it's the same, you know, it's, as I like to say, the same thing that happened in Nashville in the early 2000s with the iTunes download. That's exactly what's happened to Hollywood with Netflix and with Amazon and all of them. And just what that has done, because it's democratized the system very, very much. I mean, you know, Texas has a thriving film industry. Louisiana, I've shot in Oklahoma, I've shot in Louisiana, I've shot in Atlanta, and they're not all just simply satellites of the system. We are definitely two cultures. There's never been any doubt about that, and it's only gotten more intense. But here's the bright side of that. They are quietly reaching out to companies like me, some of the streamers especially, saying, we know that we really need to serve this audience a little bit, because they don't want to serve the audience. They want to make money. You know, so of course, there's a lot of money in the middle of the country that's going to go see the movies. So are they ever going to change and go back to the way we used to be? Doggone it. No, that's never going to happen. That's just never going to happen. And by the way, as you and I both know, a whole lot of the talent base has fled Hollywood. So I mean, ultimately, it's just change. It's not tragic. I don't want to see it fail. I mean, Hollywood is the creator of the greatest entertainment form of all time, you know, and still to this day, nobody makes them better. Nobody makes them better than there. But the independents are getting better and better and better. So I think ultimately, I'm a big glass half full guy. I think it's fine. I think there's work for everybody.
Yeah, and I think Hollywood can't keep going the way that it's going. It's sort of imploding, and it depends so heavily now on foreign audiences. And I think that's, you know, I think they were excited at the beginning about reaching out to China, for example, or South Korea, as these huge huge audiences there, and the huge money potential. But I think they're beginning to see that it's backfiring, that depending entirely like they are on foreign audiences is not working. So I do think I'm glad to hear that they're kind of reaching out, quietly though it may be, to these independent companies like yours and the ones that are producing some other content for the flyover Americans, like Sound of Freedom, that Jim Caviezel movie recently. So I'm glad to hear that Hollywood is gradually beginning to wise up. Let's talk about what's next for you, because I understand that you have a biopic called Peter that's set for production next year, directed by the same director who did Sound of Freedom, which is a good sign. Tell us about Peter.
Well, I'm working with a wonderful studio in, back to your point, your previous point here, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And these guys are the real thing. And they also were part of the producing team on Reagan. And they have set up a great little studio there. And so Alejandro Monteverdi, the director of Sound of Freedom, which you just referenced, is I'm working with the producers. They've taken my screenplay. And for Peter, I just wrote it on spec. I just, you know, I want to tell a story about the Apostle Peter. Alejandro and his partner have written all over my screenplay. And you know what? They're really good writers. So that's just fine. It's what it is. So we're now set for production, I think, sometime early in the second quarter of next year. That's all the business pieces are falling into place to shoot. Right now, it's between Morocco and Malta. because just for where it is and how it is, and it's just simply going to be easier to recreate the biblical time there. So yeah, it's a real thing. I mean, I wrote the movie more like Mel Gibson would tell the story than, you know, like than like a traditional little Christian movie. We all know what we're talking about. I've made them. I'm not at all dissing them, but just you know, think more like a tone of the Passion of the Christ and things like that. So we're really excited about that, and I think it's going to have a very large global outreach.
Yes, I'm very excited about it too, actually. I think Peter's a great subject for a biopic, and there are so many other biblical stories that are there, just waiting there to be mined and brought to the big screen. I, you know, we could just keep going back to that well over and over again. Howie, what is the best place for people to go to keep up with what you're doing?
Well, my little website, which I need to tell everybody, I am at Mark, you know this because you and I have been struggling with my end trying to get digitally connected here. I'm finally, as my kids have said, Dad, you've got to get a website. So my website is howieclausner.com, and i40studios.com will be launching before this month is out, and it's got several of my new projects coming up on there, and just basically telling you my mission. That's just basically what it is. And you're 100% right, as my kids are 100% right. It's time to get out of skunk works mode and come out. This is what I'm doing, people. And it's this movement that you're talking about is alive and well, and it's wonderful. And it's, I think, just that when we say independent, really we're just talking about, as you just said. I just met with a company the other day called Flyover, and that's exactly, they're doing the same thing. There's lots of companies like me. It's like, hey, we're content creators. We're taking this out to this underserved audience. So absolutely. I'm sorry, you've got me. I'm a little loquacious this morning, but i40 Studios and howieclausner.com.
Awesome. So are you much of a social media guy? Is there a, you know, an X account or?
No, and I need to get there as well. I was an early Facebook guy. Just some of the toxicity, honestly, in the 2016 election and everything. I just said, you know what? I'm too ADD to begin with. So my wife is. My wife tells me everything on Facebook that I need to know. But it's just not my thing. I'm not judging it. It's just me personally. I can get overwhelmed pretty quickly in social media.
Oh, I hear that. I'm exactly the same way. Actually, I should be doing more on social media, but
me too. Me too.
As you said, there's a lot of toxicity there.
Yes.
That's not worth dealing with. Howie Klausner, thanks so much for coming to the Right Take podcast. Great chatting with you. I'm going to have you back again when things get moving on Peter. Listeners, get his film Reagan on DVD and pass it down to your kids or grandkids, because as progressives understand all too well, today's entertainment is largely how history is going to be remembered and perceived by future generations. And I think Reagan is the kind of filmmaking that we should be supporting if we care about preserving really truthful alternatives to the left-wing narratives. You will thank yourself for getting it. But thanks for coming on, Howie.
Mark, I really enjoyed it. And yes, everybody, thank you. And thanks for rooting us on. Appreciate it.
And thank you, listeners, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.
The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.